My name is Laurens Schacht, and welcome to Cybersecurity Talks, the interview podcast for cybersecurity professionals and for those who aspire to become one. Join us on our journey and learn about the latest trends, real-life war stories, and everything you need to know about this fascinating industry.
I'm very excited to sit down with today's guest, who's wearing a really cool shirt with all sorts of security challenges on it, saying "Hacking Google," Richelin Pillay. Richelin has been working in the industry since 2008. His cybersecurity career has really brought him all over the world. Richelin is also an author of several offensive security books, and he's a security researcher and a threat intel researcher since a very, very long time. I saw he holds 74 different security certifications. What a show off you are, Richelin. Richelin is originally from South Africa, but has been living in the Netherlands since 2020. This turned out to be a pivotal moment in his life and his career, as he then switched from Microsoft South Africa to join Google in the Netherlands. His current focus is on the new SIEM and SOC solution from Google called Google Chronicle. But as we just discovered, we're going to have a big update from Richelin himself. Well, welcome to the show, Richelin. It's a real honor to have you with us today.
Thanks, Laurens. I think the honor is actually mine to be invited to Cybersecurity Talks. And I'm really looking forward to chatting to you today.
Yeah, no, exciting. I saw you came in, and as somebody from South Africa, I wanted to ask you, how do you like these summer days where you're completely covered in the rain?
You know, a funny thing is, like, I've been to the Netherlands probably 15 to 17 times before I actually moved here. And the very first time I got here, I experienced the typical Dutch weather. And I was like, what the heck is going on, right? And now that I'm living here, I kind of like it, actually, because it's a good flow, I guess, of change. Maybe sometimes it's not nice, right? It can be gloom, I guess. I still do miss the African sun, as we call it in South Africa, right? That real, like, if you watch The Lion King, you've seen the sun and the sunset scenes. That's the African sun. But I like the weather here, so I prefer cool weather, so for me, this is much better.
Yeah, the seasons are nice here, I must agree, but coming here on my bike this morning in the rain, it's not ideal. And as I said before we pressed recording, you gave a rather big update, because within Google, you're going to become a principal consultant for the Mandiant Red Team. That's super exciting. Can you elaborate a bit more on maybe what Mandiant does, but also what your new role is going to be like?
Yeah, sure thing. So yeah, that's going to be a big career change for me, moving to a red team. It's going to be something that I've been wanting to do for quite some time, and it aligns up a lot better with my background and my skill set. So Mandiant, wow. I mean, we can speak for hours on Mandiant. If you think of, like, you know, frontline intelligence, incident response, when you are hacked and you need somebody to help you, that's the team or company, rather, that you would call, right? So Mandiant's been around for a very long time. They've got a good track record. They've basically, you know, their history speaks for themselves, so to speak. So yeah, looking forward to moving into that role. I'm going to be focusing more on the cyber rangers of Mandiant. The team is actually called Threat Space. So that's going to be cool, because then we're going to be pretty much, like, you know, I'll be hacking machines and getting paid to do that.
That's the good life. But you said it stems from being sort of an incident response type of firm, but you're on the red team. So how does that all work?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, over and above just incident response, what Mandiant also does is, like, companies might need a red team assessment or a compromise assessment. And not many companies can afford to actually have that, right? I mean, not many companies can actually have a full-on red teamer and pay them the salary compared to, like, the other big firms that are out there. So they go to companies like Mandiant and say, hey, you know, can you come and do a red team assessment? And we want to assess our security, right? And that's how the red team practice kind of works.
So this is a good change for you.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned as a little kid, you saw the movie Hackers, the original one. Was that sort of the first moment that you felt, hey, this cybersecurity, this hacking stuff is something I want to learn more about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I was introduced to hacking by the movie, right? So that was my first movie that I watched. I was pretty young and I found it like really cool. And I thought to myself, wow, this is so awesome. Like imagine you could just hack stuff, right? Like be the bad guy, do things digitally. Nobody can trace you or track you. And from then I started to be like really interested in tinkering with PCs. And yeah, I started to like play around with whatever I could find. Back then, the chat that existed was Microsoft Internet Relay Chat, or MIRC, as people might know it. And we would join like all these different chat rooms and try to figure out like, you know, who could you hack on this chat room? How could you phish them? Or how could you gain some information about them? Send them a malicious file, try to open up a backdoor to their machine and do all sorts of bad stuff.
That's how the most brilliant hackers start their career. But at what age was this that you start fooling around?
Wow, I think it was about, probably I was around about 12 or 13, I guess. I got into PCs very young. My mom used to take me with her to work. And this was like during school holidays and stuff like that. So, you know, I used to accompany her to her work, and pretty much I used to work on like a 486 that she had. And I used to help her out with like doing invoicing and stuff like that. When I look back at it now, you know, she kind of used me, I guess, to do all her work. Who knows, right? But on the flip side, I got exposed to PCs, right? And I started to work on like a 486. The very first game that I played was Dig Dug on that 486. And that PC was so old, like it was black and white. It still had like a turbo button, and you press the turbo button and the PC goes faster, right? And I started to started to explore PCs at that stage. Like Windows wasn't around. My very first Windows machine was like a Packard Bell, and it was a Pentium 75. It was Windows 95, right? And yeah, from then I just like started to mess around with PCs and got to where I am today.
And were you more the type of boy playing around with computers, or more sportive, or was it a combination? I'm also curious, how is that in South Africa? Was there already a big hacking scene for young boys and girls?
Not really. I mean, I was more an inside boy, right? I used to be on my PC or playing video games. I was never active, like playing sports and stuff like that. I guess also like in South Africa, it's not that safe. So not many people would be outside, right? Like if I look at now in the Netherlands, kids are playing outside in the rain, right? And you could leave your kid in the playground and pretty much go and grab a coffee and like your kid will still be there, right? South Africa was a much different scene. So I found myself more indoors playing video games. Funny enough, till now, my wife still laughs about it because my son is the complete opposite. He likes to play outside. And sometimes I want him to be inside. And she's like, you know, don't do that. Just like, he doesn't have to be a mini version of you. Let him do what he wants to do, you know.
For sure. Yeah, that's beautiful. And what was for you the moment that you thought, I want to make a career out of this? I feel I'm good at it. What can I do to really make a living?
Yeah, so I mean, I got into studying PCs like fully. Funny enough, I didn't do like any degrees or any university type of courses. I started focusing on vendor neutral courses, like the ones from CompTIA. And I did my A+, and I did my Network+, and then I started to focus on Microsoft certifications, because back then like MCSE was like the de facto standard of a certification. And I started to do MCSE, and they started to introduce like the MCSE security. And I figured like, hey, this is pretty cool. Like now we're starting to get an actual security certification. We had Security Plus and so forth. And as I got into my first job, it was for a systems engineer. And I remember during the interview, I mentioned to the hiring manager, like, hey, I'm quite keen on learning about security and moving into the security front. And fortunately, he had a role in the security team. And he's like, well, okay, if you want to go that way, yes, I'll put you in the security team. So I got introduced into the security team and I started working on like firewalls and stuff like that. Man, I was so, it's so funny when I look back at it, like I was so stupid, right? I didn't even know what network address translation was. And like, I'm setting up this first firewall rule and nothing's working. And then I learned like, oh crap, I have to do network address translation, right? And when I look at it now, it's like, how stupid were you?
Times have changed.
Yeah.
But it's cool that you've been in the industry since the beginning. Yeah. And after your first job, you start working for Accenture South Africa then. And you stuck around for 7.5 years. That's quite a long journey. What were your main learnings from that period?
Yeah, so when I moved to Accenture, I started to become more exposed to like the corporate level of security. This was more on the network security front. So I started touching like, you know, different firewall vendors. I started touching like Juniper, Cisco, switching, IPS, IDS type of devices. And I learned a lot from a network front. At that level of my career, I started to pursue like the CCIE from Cisco. It's a very difficult exam. Like I failed it 3 times. And I stayed in that for 7 years. If I look at it, you know, if I look back now, that's probably something I could have changed. Like I wouldn't have stayed in there for 7 years, right? I should have actually made a move sooner to start to progress my career further. So I kind of fell into a comfort zone in that 7 years.
And from learning perspective, because you said it was more corporate and of course Accenture is more client facing. I assume that brought a lot of learning, going to clients, giving presentations. Was that a good learning school? Would you recommend it to youngsters out there?
Actually, in my role at Accenture, I was based on the internal security team. So I never went to customers. And funny enough, I never liked going to customers. And till now, I still kind of don't like it. Although in my last two roles, I was doing that quite a bit. What I would say for people out there and the younger generation, yes, it's good, right? It gives you a lot of exposure. It gives you a lot of insight into what other customers are doing, the levels of maturity and so forth. As I think about like my transition when I moved to Microsoft, that's where I started to like really go and talk to customers. And not only in South Africa, but like in Europe and other parts of the world. And that's where you start to see the difference in maturity of the countries and cybersecurity as a whole, right, in these countries.
Yeah, because you said that maybe I should have left Accenture earlier, but eventually you make a big move to join Microsoft. How did it came about and what were you hired for then?
At that time of my life, I figured like it's time to make this move, which was way long overdue. And I moved to Microsoft. Actually, funny enough, Microsoft approached me for the role. They approached me twice. The first time I declined, the second time I took the role. And it was a big change, right? Because I was moving from network security to software-based security, essentially cloud-based security. I mean, at that stage, Azure existed, but Azure was still, you know, pretty young at the time. So for me, I was like, wow, this is going to be a challenge. Like going from firewalls that you can touch and see to firewalls that you can't touch and you can't see, you know? And I looked at it as a challenge and I was like, well, for me to progress my career, I have to start moving towards the cloud, like everybody, you know, in the world was doing. And I took the role and moved to Microsoft.
Well, what did you notice the first days or weeks? Was it different? The people, the mentality, the quality? I'm very curious what it's like. I feel people at Microsoft, Google, it's not easy to get in. It's probably very competitive. You have really the top performance of the world that land those type of positions. So I'm very curious to know how did you feel in the beginning? You felt at home or you felt I had to push for things?
At the beginning, I felt like a bit overwhelmed, honestly. I mean, when you get into these companies, you realize that you're not the smartest person in the room. There's a lot of other people that are out there that are way smarter than you, right? And I think the same is true, not only for those type of companies, but generally in companies around the world. So I felt a bit overwhelmed. It was a bit of a mindset change as well, because like hardly anyone was in the office. Everybody was working from a customer site or whatever, right? And I had to get used to the fact that like they treat you as your own person, like you're a big boy, so to speak. Look after yourself, right? like, obviously there's the ramp up and they give you all of that, the business stuff to get you acquired and acquainted rather with Microsoft. But then, like, you have to manage your own time. And at first it was like, this is pretty cool. Like, I mean, if I want to go home early on a Friday, nobody's going to care as long as your work is done. So that was nice.
And you had customers across the world, you mentioned that you really saw the different maturity levels from different industries and different countries. Can you go a bit deeper on that? What were some of the main surprises that you discovered?
Yeah, so I mean, if I look at like the customer base in South Africa, I've worked on mature customers in South Africa who had their security posture really well maintained. And then I worked on like universities in the country where the security posture was like really bad, right? And as an example, I worked at one university and it was during an incident response case where they were so badly breached that the only option we had was to unplug them from the internet and basically reformat and get everything set up again. On the flip side, when I started to travel to Europe and I started to visit some of the customers in the Netherlands, especially as well, I got to a customer where I did a security assessment, and out of like, you know, probably 1,000 findings, they probably had like 10. And I still looked at it and I was like, this can't be right. I probably did something wrong. I reran the assessment and the results were the same. And I was like, wow, these guys are, you know, pretty jacked up. Their security is pretty jacked up. And yeah, it was good to see the difference in maturity. You know, on the other side also, there were some customers in the Netherlands where the security was pretty bad, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, it just depends on how serious they take cybersecurity.
Yeah, and you've always been more on the offensive side, eh? Trying to find the vulnerabilities. What was maybe the most surprising finding during your time at Microsoft?
Yes, I've always been on the offensive side. And I think that gave me a bit of a competitive edge. Because knowing how to breach a system, you understand how to protect it better. So when I worked at Microsoft, a couple of customers that I've worked at, they actually had like their cloud environments compromised, right? And I won't say it was like a wow factor, but what was interesting is how the attackers moved to the cloud and the way they pivot across different like systems on their local on-premise networks to get into the cloud environments. And it was good to actually understand like the modus operandi of the attacker, what they were trying to do and how they worked, right? And the different skills of the attackers as well, because you've got different skilled attackers that are out there. And it's good to see that, how they actually use it.
Can you go a bit deeper on this? Because this is very interesting. Usually people think, okay, now I'm moving everything to the cloud. It's within Azure, so we're pretty much solid, but that's not really the case, of course. But I'm very curious how did these bad guys get into the system then?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, all of the cloud environments, irrespective of the name of the vendor, there is good security, right? There are statistics that are out there that show 99% of cloud breaches are due to misconfigurations on customer side. And many attackers that I've seen, including the big names that are out there, if you look at like APT29, you know, FIN6, those type of attackers, they don't simply just go directly to the cloud and try to breach the cloud because they know like Microsoft, Azure, and Google have really well advanced security teams that's going to look after the cloud environments. So the easiest point of entry is through the customer and generally also like through contractors that the customer might have, right? So they would get in from a customer side due to a misconfiguration, move laterally, find a privileged account and easily escalate their privilege into the cloud environment. From all the incident response cases that I've worked on, that's what I've seen. I mean, yeah, you do get sometimes a customer might have a compute engine in the cloud that's so badly misconfigured that they can easily breach and then they directly in the cloud, you know, but those are like, I won't say special cases, but they very few.
And the threat actors, were there similar groups? Because I assume you worked with a lot of big corporate organizations, both with Microsoft and Google. Do you see similar groups that just know how to get in? or is it really diverse, or the more state actors? I'm just trying to see who are you competing with on the other side?
Yeah, it's diverse, right? I mean, there's different threat actors that have different end games, so to speak. Some of them are out for money, some of them are out for data theft, right? So it just depends, really. I guess it also depends on the type of organization that you have. Like if you're a healthcare provider, well, the data is going to be, you know, prime target for a customer. Not for a customer, but rather for an attacker. But if you like a financial institution, well, you're going to be a prime target for ransomware, right? So it just depends on that.
And over the years, who you start fearing most? Is it state actors or the small, well-organized groups?
I would say the state actors are definitely ones that you should be scared of, or any organization should be scared of, because those guys are funded really well, of course, from the nation states, right? And generally, to become a hacker in a nation state, you have to be like the best of the best. So I know there are stories about like certain countries where they actually go out to the universities and look for hackers, and they actually employ them and take them into like the so-called nation state school of hacking, and they become a hacker, right? And they really like throw money at them, throw training at them and stuff like that. And then they become really good. On the flip side, organizations should not only be scared about nation states, but they should also be scared about the employees that are internal, because a disgruntled employee can be just as dangerous as a nation state.
Yeah, the insider risk.
Correct.
Yeah. You see a swift, so that it's more coming from insider risks, so that the employees might get upset when they get fired or have to leave. Is that becoming a bigger risk?
Probably not that much, right? I mean, generally when organizations have a disgruntled employee, they take swift action to get the access revoked. I think that's one of the first things that they do. The challenge becomes when the employee is disgruntled before the organization knows about it, because then they could already start sharing secrets or sharing data and stuff like that, right? On the other side, it also comes down to awareness as well for your internal employees, because if your internal employees do not treat security as their own security for the company, they can also get easily phished and so forth, right? So it's a bit of a mix.
And for Microsoft, I think you guys have had a very important role and responsibility, because you really protect all sorts of governments, all critical infrastructures, all Dutch hospitals run on Microsoft. So did you also feel a bigger sense of responsibility?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I ran like security assessments with customers, and you see the gaps that they would have, and especially like, you know, you say hospitals and governments and so forth, it's, you know, you think to yourself like, wow, like imagine if you had somebody, a family member in the hospital, and now they've got all these security risks. And one of the things that an attacker could do would be like hold the entire hospital ransom, right? Switch off life support machines, because let's face it, some of those are connected to the internet somehow. It becomes something that's really, you know, it's got a lot of weight on it. The same with banks. You think of a bank, like you might be saying, hey, my money is in that bank, right? If this bank gets hacked so badly and they can't like recover, my money is gone. Because at the end of the day, it's all digital money. It's not like physical money that you have, right? So yeah, there's a lot of responsibility and weight that you would feel, well, I personally felt. And I try to channel that in such a way that I could make the person I'm delivering the results to aware, like, hey, this is something really serious. Like, you really need to consider this, you know, because if you look at the steps or the blocks further, there's a lot of implications that can happen.
Yeah. But in all these years, you've probably seen very sophisticated cases with state actors, very well planned hacks. But sometimes it's also the human element, the human factor. Do you have some funny examples that it was very sophisticated or just too easy to get in?
Yes, I do. So it came down to one of my trips when I worked at Microsoft. The airport that I was traversing actually was one of our customers. And funny enough, I was speaking to the security team to say, hey, you guys need to kind of, you know, adjust your security and so forth. And I was leaving, and I always have this habit of traveling with two machines, one my corporate issued machine and the other one my personal machine, which I have like Kali Linux and all my Wi-Fi adapters and all the hacking stuff loaded on it. And I sat at the lounge and I said, well, I've got like 2 hours to kill. Let me see what I can do, right? So I fired up my machine and got onto the Wi-Fi and started to just explore a little bit. And eventually I found myself like on some servers, right, from the public Wi-Fi. And I was like, wow, this is interesting. Started to record my screen because I want to use this to go back to the customer and say, hey, look how far I'm getting just by exploring. And eventually I got onto like some Dell DRAC systems and I could switch machines off. And I thought, wow, okay, this is now really bad. And I got the details of the machine and I got onto the machine and so forth. And I picked up the phone, my cell phone, and I phoned the customer and I said, hey, I'm on this machine. What is this machine? And he said, that's one of the flight controller machines.
Oh, man.
And I said, like, wow, are you shitting me right now? And he's like, no, seriously, that's one of our flight controller machines. And I said, well, let me show you my screen. And I turned my phone and I said, look, I can actually switch it off. And he like, you know, lost his shit. He was like, what's going on? How did you get onto this machine?
Wow.
And I said, dude, I got on from your public Wi-Fi.
And what a mess.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, for me, it was really funny, to be honest, because I was like, you know, I kind of told you guys, you don't listen. But anyway, this is how far I could get. And I mean, anybody could get to that level. It wasn't like you didn't really need to know offensive security that well. It's not like I ran any exploits or anything like that. It was just pure on reconnaissance. And yeah, that was a really funny story.
Yeah. Okay, because I think I know you a bit longer, but you're one of the craziest offensive security people out there. I think if you give yourself a good laptop in a couple of hours, you can get into a lot of things that you should not get into. So that's it's really an excellent skill. But to come back to that airport, I'm very curious what happens then on the other side. So for the IT department, that should be a major eye-opener and it should be, okay, we need to drop our stuff and get going immediately. Does that also happen at clients when this is really such a significant breach that is now prevented? But what happens then on the client side?
You'll be surprised. Some customers reacted that way and they'll like drop everything and try to fix things. Some, unfortunately, don't care, right? They'll be like, well, okay, we'll look into it. They never had a breach. They don't care. They might not even know that an attacker is actually on the environment, you know? So yeah, it's a mixed spectrum. I mean, I've been with some customers where they had pen tests done and banks specifically, and they got like, you know, really far into the banking system to the point of depositing fictitious money and actually withdrawing cash of that amount. And I got like, you know, documents that I would find on the internet publicly available with metadata embedded into it with their user accounts, which for an attacker would be, it's actually pretty cool to have that because now you know the structure of the user names and you can start to craft like, you know, phishing attacks and so forth. Those type of customers, when I brought that to their attention, like the entire security team was woken up at like, you know, midnight to get working on this right away, fix it. Yeah. So it's a mix.
Yeah. Wow. It's very interesting. Yeah. And I want to switch gears a little bit because in 2020, there's a big change in your life, in your career, because you decide to move to the Netherlands and become a Googler. How did this happen? Because it's in a way, perhaps from Microsoft security to Google security, it could be seen as a sensitive move. But I'm curious, how did it go? Were you approached? Did you apply?
So I was actually approached by Google. I figured, like, why not, right? I mean, I didn't know much of what Google does apart from what everybody knows what Google does, right? I didn't know anything about the internal security. And I was approached to be a security practice lead, to head up the security practice for the Benelux, specifically on Google Cloud. And I went through the process. You know, Google has a reputation of having many interviews. I think I was fortunate I had 3 interviews, which was okay. And eventually I got the role. You know, it was a pivotal moment in my life because it was mid-COVID. My son was like 1 year old. And we were actually sitting, my wife and I, we were like, hey, you know, like South Africa is great, but to grow up a kid, you know, maybe not so great. And the door opened for Google. And with the Google job was the relocation to the Netherlands. So it was a no-brainer to take it. And there's always this conception about Google engineering, you know, far exceeds other customers and other cloud providers. And the way Google does things is like on a different scale, you know. And I figured like, hey, this is going to be a really cool challenge. So I accepted the role. It was a bit stressful purely on the move because of COVID time. I mean, we were like, we sold everything in our house and we were like living on, you know, just having like lawn chairs inside the house that we had to use to sit and watch TV. And eventually I could like the governments lifted the restrictions and we could move, right? Got to the Netherlands. And I still remember it was so funny because it was COVID in the Netherlands as well. So nobody was in the streets. And I walked out from the hotel to Albert Heijn and I heard the sirens, right? These emergency sirens. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what the hell is happening, right? Why are these sirens going off? I mean, you see this in the movies, like a war siren or something going off. Like, are they going to come and bomb the shit out of the place? So it was really funny. But yeah, it was all part of the experience.
Yeah. But it must have been difficult, yeah, to make that transfer during times like that. And you mentioned that the interview process is well known and fierce. I think that you had 3 rounds is they went easy on you. But was it super challenging? Because from our background as recruiters, we also try to help companies in the hiring process. Like what type of questions do you ask? What questions you should not ask, for instance, and to strategize a bit about the hiring process. But what were some of the questions that you've seen and that you also like to ask yourself as a hiring manager now?
Yeah, it was challenging. I won't lie. Like we have obviously the technical interview, which is, you know, I guess the easiest of the lot because it's really on technical skills. But then Google has interviews on cognitive analysis, more around thinking capability. We have like something that we call googliness. That's actually a real word in Google. And it's just to kind of see how you would fit in with other Googlers. And then we have like a leadership type of an interview, like how you would approach a scenario and questions around like, you know, what have you failed at? How did you get over that, right? Or Or if you had a fallout with a colleague, how did you address that? You know, really difficult questions if you think of it. From the cognitive side, it's more around thinking capability. So they would give you a scenario and that's it. You have to kind of talk through how you would fix the scenario. And they kind of look at like, do you ask questions? How much questions do you ask? Do you talk too much? You know, so there's a lot of interesting twerks in the interview process.
Yeah. And was it much different from the Microsoft?
Oh, yeah.
Procedure?
Yeah. Way different.
And do you also see a different culture or a different type of personality within the two companies?
Yes, definitely. Microsoft is still a bit more corporate, I feel. You know, maybe now things have changed. I'm not sure. Google is like a different beast, right? I mean, Google, you know, you've came to our offices, right? You've seen some of the presentations that I've done. I do it in jeans and a t-shirt.
Yeah. Right. Same outfit as today. Yeah.
Same as today, and funky shoes, and that's it, right? And that's Google. That's the culture in Google. It's be who you are, right? As long as you do good work and you, our motto is don't be evil, right? Don't do evil. So be who you are, and that's it.
Oh, well, that's fascinating. Yeah. It's a rather unique culture.
Yes, it is.
And for you, was that a reason to join Google, or also just the vastness and the the technology always at the front edge and really changing the world with every thinkable add-on that comes out?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was definitely being exposed to more, being exposed to Google Cloud and what we're doing in Google, being exposed to like the people as well, right? Because, I mean, if you think of it, like we've got self-driving cars, right? We've got a massive AI division, and being exposed to those type of people to understand like, you know, what was your thinking when you built the self-driving car? Like, how did you figure this out, you know? And then, of course, with the move to the Netherlands, which was a driving factor as well, and, you know, just looking at overall, it was just like the perfect opportunity at the perfect time.
Yeah. But it's so cool that you work with these brilliant people and that they are so future-driven. That must also be very inspiring. And what you said earlier, like, don't try to be the smartest person in the room. It's maybe also not the dumbest person in the room. but I think with Google, if you speak with engineers that work on a self-driving car, it must feel really good and exciting and to just share ideas with those type of folks.
Yeah, definitely. And every day is a learning experience at Google. I mean, like being in the offensive security team, I've spoken to some members of the team and, you know, they've schooled me on stuff. I was like, wow, like I've never thought about that. Like, was I living in a rock all the time? And now all of a sudden I start to see this, you know? So it's really cool. Like you get exposed to all these people and things like that. And over and above that, like the culture in Google, if you want to contribute to the actual Google code, you can do that. Right. Like, I mean, I've contributed a bunch of stuff into Chronicle and into all the detections that we have. And not many people can actually put it on their CV or on their resume that says, I've contributed to the code of Google. You know, we never had that in Microsoft.
That's so cool. Yeah. Really, really something special. And you are really focused on securing Google itself, right? The company. And I think later on also with the designing of Chronicle, it also became a product for end users. But it was originally founded with the idea, okay, we are Google, we need to protect ourselves as good as we can. And then it became such a good product and tooling around it that you said, okay, this might also be useful for our customer base. But how does Google go about protecting herself with so many things going on? It feels like a mission impossible.
Yeah. So, of course, I mean, what I can say is that a lot of the solutions that Google has for customers is what we actually use internally as well. So Gmail, right? I use that as well. That's internally we use Gmail. If you think of like the solution for zero trust, like Beyond Corp, we use that. So what's great about the way we engineer these solutions is that if it's good enough to protect Google, then it's obviously good enough for everybody else to use, right? And that's the same mindset we apply to all of the security solutions.
But when you said I worked on the Google code, that means you've helped the Google company to protect itself better. And correct. Those features might then be used essentially also for some of the end users.
That's right.
Yeah. That's pretty sexy.
Yeah. Well, that's a good line to add into my resume.
Yeah. I think you should. Yeah. How does Google stay one step ahead of the bad guys? Because I can imagine with such a big name, with the stakes so high, with a huge attack surface all across the world, how does one go about protecting herself?
That's a really good question, Lawrence. And, you know, I can't obviously disclose much, but what I can say is we've launched a really awesome video series, which is called Hacking Google. It's available on YouTube. So for the listeners out there, just search for Hacking Google. We actually have like a full-on challenge, and it's based on like a capture the flag type of challenge. I've personally authored two challenges in that Hacking Google series, specifically around detection and response. The challenges are easy and hard. And for those that are listening, you know, go and check it out. Attempt the challenge. If you manage to solve the detection and response hard challenge, definitely reach out to me and let me know, because I would personally give you a sticker if you are based in the Netherlands. So what I can say, Lawrence, is that video series really talks about the challenges that we had as Google with attackers, right? Because we are also not immune to attackers and different nation states out there. But what we do disclose in the video is like how we've protected ourselves, right? And it's really awesome because it comes from a lot of hackers internally at Google, a lot of people in the OFSEC team. So definitely check it out. I think their messaging is going to be a lot more sweeter than mine.
Okay. And just for my understanding, how big is the information security team then within Google, like across the globe? How many people focus on the internal security?
Wow, I think we are a pretty big team. I mean, we've got different security divisions for the different solutions and so forth. We spread out across the world, right? So we've got like dedicated teams for offensive security. We've got dedicated teams for detection and response, for malware, reverse engineering and so forth, and research. So we have pretty big security team in Google.
Nice. And the shirt you're wearing is also from Hacking Google, right? I see the logos, the signs, even I believe some of the challenges that are already on the shirt. So
that's it.
I think you're really proud to work on that. And I remember you mentioned something that in the first 1 or 2 days after launching this challenge, there were like 60 or 70,000 people signing up, going for the challenge. But what's the success rate then?
So one thing with Google is when we release Capture the Flag events, it's one of the most sought out Capture the Flag, right? Because a lot of people that play Capture the Flags know like when Google releases a Capture the Flag, it's going to be really damn good, right? And when we launched Hacking Google, within the first 2 days, we had about 70,000 players. And look, some of the challenges, we had to make them easy. And then we've got some that are really hard, right? My challenge is personally, the hard challenge, only had 10 solves in the first 2 days from the 70,000 people. So hence my open challenge to all your listeners.
Okay. Well, everybody listening, go have a look and try it. Yeah, super exciting. Yeah, and then if they pass, they get a sticker. Is that all?
Well, I will personally give them a sticker if they are based in the Netherlands. If they reach out to me on LinkedIn and listening from any other country, I will definitely give you some type of a mention on LinkedIn.
Nice. Okay. Now, challenge accepted, hopefully.
Yeah.
Not about me, but about the listeners.
And you know, with me, I'm always trading stickers, and we have like really cool stickers at Google and so forth. So it's going to be a really cool sticker. Trust me.
Really cool. We definitely put the links in the show notes so that everybody can check it out and perhaps give it a go. That would be exciting. And as you said, yeah, you will be joining the Mandiant team. So that's more protecting the end customers. How excited are you?
I can't wait, to be honest. Really excited to like just, you know, focus on offensive security and try out all the different types of attacks that I've been playing around with. I've been doing it in my current role, you know, to try and build detections around these types of attacks and so forth. Now I can just focus on the attacks.
You go back to your roots.
Back to my roots and let somebody else worry about detecting me.
Awesome. As a last question, we always ask our guests if there's one signal message that you can share with all the CISOs across the world, what would that message be for you?
I would say definitely take security really, really seriously. If you are in a CISO role, you obviously are taking it seriously. But remember that there are hackers out there. Some of them are so skilled that, you know, massive companies are scared of them, right? Always remember that you are never safe. An attacker will always get into your environment. I've never seen in my entire career, even when I worked incident response, I've never seen a company that was immune to a hacker. As much as they had the best security and they were like really secure, they still got breached. So always keep that in mind. Unfortunately, the hacker is always going to win. It just means that you need to make his life more difficult for him to win.
That's beautiful. and scary. That's a great way to wrap it up. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I think what you're doing is really important for the world, for the digital society. So you can be really, really, really proud of yourself. And thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Lawrence. It was really awesome to speak to you today. And thanks for inviting me, of course. Looking forward to chatting to you again.
We will. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Cybersecurity Talks. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to review and subscribe. For all further information on our live events and new podcast releases, go to csrecruitment.nl. Thank you and stay safe.